Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week,
what's new at NEC?
The Australian's digital subscriber numbers.
Scoopon's massive Hungry Jack's deal.
Who will help the Bondi hipsters sell out?
And go back to where you came from, seeks refuge in the US. Now with us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is Chief Strategic Officer at media agency NEC, James Heyer.
Hey James, how are you going?
Very well, Tim.
And also with us, Mumbrella multimedia and marketing journalist Kathy McGinn.
Hello.
And as you've been hearing, podcast producer Colin Delaney.
Hey, hey.
Now, welcome back to the podcast, James. It's actually been a while.
Over a year.
We were having dinner last night, as I'd love to say we often do, but in fact it's been a while. And I was surprised to hear that it was a year, because, yeah, I think last time we were talking about the build-up to the Christmas before last. So clearly it has been. What actually is new at MEC at the moment?
Well, probably on a tactical front, noticed clients a lot more interested in what's going on in real time in both their categories and trying to understand their creative and that sort of thing. So what we're certainly involved in is a lot more research than I noticed in the previous year. On a personal and agency front, we're about to have an agency overhaul. So with some trepidation, we're waiting for that.
So an overhaul, that's in terms of sort of positioning and how it kind of states its position to the market.
Yeah, that's part of it. But from a more of a pain perspective, we're changing our offices. So there's going to be a massive restructure in terms of decor and that sort of thing, and it never goes well.
It's the politics, isn't it? Happily, it's not happened for 3 years, but when I worked on B&T, we used to have to move floors about every 15 minutes, and just the politics of managing where everyone sits and who gets a seat next to the window and all of that sort of thing is genuinely, it's the most miserable moments of management when people become fussed about their little piece of territory.
Yeah, the great thing is misery is equally spread. No one's actually happy.
So will you just be will you be campaigning for your space, or will you have to be making some of the decisions?
Already demarked.
Now, NEC, the Nielsen rankings came out just the other day. You held steady, actually, still at sort of 10th biggest agency, obviously part of Group M, probably the biggest single buying group.
Not probably, Tim.
Yes, I suppose. the measurements always come in on what do you measure as Mitchells and Aegis and all of that sort of thing. But yes, clearly it's the battle between the two beasts. But yes, what do you make of your position within that market?
Well, certainly, I mean, we're happy to be part of the top 10. It's obviously really important when it comes to, you know, talking to clients that you've got a size that allows them to have the expertise and the skill that they're looking for. And, you know, from our perspective, we're also the size, which means you'll actually get to meet the people that saw you in the pitch. Obviously, with Group M, it means that we've got the scale that you don't miss out, you know, with one of the bigger agencies in the market.
We've just heard this week that Barry O'Brien from PhD will be moving on. It's a big gap left in the industry.
Yeah, I think so. It's be interesting to understand why he's decided at this point to move on. Certainly, I think that PhD have got a bit of momentum in the market and they're doing well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where he lands up next.
Because Barry is a big character, sort of old school, you know, I guess he was seen as old school retail as much as anything, really, you know. So, but one of those people you never, ever hear anyone say anything bad about.
Yeah, which is actually surprising, and yeah, notably on your column and on the wall, there were no comments which were to his detriment, which I think is a testament to him versus anything that really happens in this industry.
Kathy, you've met Barry on a couple of occasions. Your impressions of him?
Yeah, he's certainly a big character and I think a lovely guy.
Another big move is John Harlow, founder of Naked Communications in London, and his move to Perth's The Brand Agency as Director of Comms Planning. James, does this say anything about Australia as the place for big media thinkers to work? Feel free to compliment yourself on this, obviously.
Look, I think it's good news for Perth. I mean, obviously, he has his reasons for going there, which may or may not have to do with Perth's advertising circle.
Yeah, certainly it's been said in the original story, family reasons is one of the reasons.
But I think, I mean, he certainly was a great character. Started a revolution in media, certainly in the UK, and that spread worldwide. And I think it'll be a really positive influence for Perth. It'll be interesting to see, you know, if he outgrows it or not.
Now, for those who weren't sort of familiar with the kind of the growth of Naked, I guess you probably sort of had a chance to sort of, you've obviously seen what they've done here in Australia, but saw what they did in London. What was it that they did that kind of redefined that area of the market, do you think?
Well, I think they started the changes that we've seen today, which is basically the areas around which, you know, the creative agency thought they were the sole provider have been blurred. And with Naked's entry and the idea that they could work with anyone without any platform bias and they could, heaven forbid, actually be creative, started the trend we see today where right now, from PR through to digital, through to media and creative agencies, there's a war on, obviously right now in social, and that will change in the next year or two as something else comes along. And there are no rules, in all honesty, anymore as to who owns what we talk about as content.
So is this something that we should be thanking them for or resenting them for?
Well, from our side, definitely thanking them. I mean, it was an idea that time was right. I think the media independence had broken away. They'd found their feet. And in all honesty, Naked and a number of other shops like Nota Bene, the Media Kitchen, actually showed the way. And what media agencies are doing today, in all honesty, is thanks to the small shops that started up then.
I think that what they've done, and other agencies like them, is to really taking the idea isn't worth anything unless you execute it brilliantly. And I think that saying that the idea only lives with creative agency means that the execution can often be less good.
Next, the Australians' paywall numbers.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week, The Australian revealed a glimpse into its paywall stats. It wasn't much, but we did get to see there are 30,000 paying subscribers, 40,000 in total. Chief Operating Officer of The Australian, John Allen, admitted it was still very early days, but said it was an encouraging start. Tim, you described it as a glimpse of digital ankle. It wasn't much to go on. What do we know?
Yeah, so, I mean, you sum up the top line very well, which is, yes, 30,000 paying subscribers. The big question is, how much have they been paying and what sort of subscriber are they? Because this is a mixture of different types of subscriber, everything from somebody who has on one given day subscribed once to a facsimile, effectively, of that day's paper as it comes out, which would cost $2, through to someone who pays for the 6-day-a-week print and digital combo for 6 months, which would cost them out sort of $37 or something, or, you know, sort of 70-something bucks per year. Now, if you times 2 by 30,000, then that's not much money at all. But if you charge, you know, 70 or 80 bucks by 30,000, that's quite a lot. Certainly not the sort of revenues that newspapers bring in. I guess what these numbers don't include as well is any kind of revenue that comes in against advertising against the digital products. This is only the subscribers part of the story. So, yeah, it's a little bit of transparency. News say, and I believe them, that they had an internal sweepstakes. I'd heard people say this anecdotally before about how many people would sign up for the, I think it was for the trial of the paywall, because there's a 3-month free trial before they were asked to pay, and the numbers exceeded everybody's guess in the sweepstakes. So that suggests they were happy with that bit. And of course, what we haven't got is the difference in numbers between the number of people who trialed it and then the number of people who then actually chose to pay money at the end of the 3 months, which is a kind of crucial point.
James, what sort of data would you be wanting to see before you invested ads behind the paywall?
Well, I think you actually need to take a step back. The lucky thing for The Australian is it has a couple of years to try and sort this out. If you look at the States, they're having what we're talking about as the crossover happening in 2012, which is digital advertising will surpass all of print. We estimate that will happen in the next 2.5-3 years in Australia, digital growing at 3, print going back at -2 each year. What this really means is, if you look at Australians' revenues right now, their digital advertising is about a 60th of their offline advertising revenue. Now, to make up that sort of gap, it's going to have a significant increase in the number of people that are subscribing, and that's why they've got to do the sort of test that they're doing now, but they have a very, very short window to actually do this.
In terms of MEC, how long do you think before what MEC invests on behalf of its clients in online would exceed what it currently invests in print?
I think that basically we're driven by the market, we're driven by consumers.
And
right
do you,
now,
do you see the lines coming close to crossing?
We see them coming close to crossing, and I'd probably say the next 36 months, definitely from a newspaper's perspective. Certainly within the next 60 months, I would see the digital spend being greater than all of print spend.
It was interesting. So this is going slightly off the topic. It was interesting seeing the Comscore figures that came out a few days ago, and their tracking of the display ad spend. And there were a couple of numbers that I found fascinating. Firstly, that they calculate that 23% of display ads served in this market are served on Facebook alone, which just is sort of incredible reach. But the other one was the sheer number of... There were two things, dating sites, but then the one that I found a massive relief that there were two of them in the top 10 was Weight Watchers and Light and Easy, the food product, which was a huge relief because I've been seeing those ads everywhere I go and I assumed I was being behaviourally targeted. So it was actually a relief to see that everybody else was getting them. But Kathy, going back to the paywall side of things, your thoughts?
Well, I don't think it's... I think it's a really difficult call to make. I don't think that journalism lends itself to being hidden behind a login. And I think I actually can't see how it's going to work long term, because the nature of digital is that it's leaky. It's very easy for content to get out and to be shared freely.
There's this, I think it's Jeff Jarvis quote, information wants to be free.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you try and... I think that the way forward might not be to monetize the site itself, but rather look at different models of how people might pay to be in spaces.
I'm not sure I agree.
Oh, that is your
prerogative. I guess for newspapers, their job actually isn't, you know, they have no duty to give their journalism to everybody who wants it. So if their model works better, whereby only 5% of their current readers receive it, but they pay for it, then... If there's a business model there which is better than the existing business model, then, hey, bad luck to the other 95%.
But might there not be a more interesting business model around the kind of ads and where you serve them so that they're super targeted, that we use much more kind of ambient personalisation, that sort of stuff, so that you know that you're talking to the three people who are actually going to buy a product, for example?
Yeah, and I suppose that's kind of the direction that Fairfax have gone in with at least they're beginning to go in asking people to register to use the site, and if you actually register and share more information, you can have greater controls, you can switch off autoplay on the video in exchange for giving them some kind of demographic information about yourself.
Well, look at Google Plus and Facebook. I mean, people are prepared to give away enormous amounts of personal data, and which is obviously huge help to advertisers. I don't see that means that journalism has to pay for it.
But you see, I think it's both. I'm also quite willing to give to share some of my data if I'm served more relevant ads. That's fine. But I just think that there's probably more than one model as well.
This is the problem. It's digital cents and offline dollars. And the reality is the revenues that the Australian is seeing right now from offline will never be realised in online. And they have to move from, you know, a cash or revenue business to a margin business and understand that they will... You know, they'll lose about 2/3 of their cost, which will be the print, the paper, the presses, the trucks, the nice buildings. And in return, they'll have a more marginally profitable business.
From an industrial estate on the edge of town somewhere.
Correct.
Can we expect a little more insight anytime soon?
Yeah, but it's a good question because the insight so far is, you know, is relatively low. Arguably, Fairfax set the agenda on this one a bit when they released some information a couple of weeks back. I suspect that if you were to ask News Limited, they would say, oh, we were always going to do this week, because this was also the week that they switched on the paywall for the Herald Sun in Melbourne as well. So, you know, it was all about releasing some data on the same day they were having a bit of a debate about journalism and the future of journalism in Melbourne, which they kind of video streamed as well. So, yeah, it would be nice to see a bit more. I mean, they did say they would release it in the coming months when the ABC, the Audit Bureau, starts changing the way that they measure audiences to actually take in these digital audiences, which I think months is a good word, because months could also mean years, and you know, generally, you know, there are an awful lot of individual interests with something like the Audit Bureau. So actually getting a new policy that everyone will sign up to, I can see not being that swift.
This week, as you mentioned, the Herald Sun launched its freemium model. Given the specialist business nature of the Australian that it's offering, how do you expect the Herald Sun to go? I mean, most readers won't be able to write off a tabloid subscription as work.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because, you know, certainly what we saw, for example, with the AFR, which I guess has had the paywall for the longest, is I suspect that the majority of people who had that subscription were sticking on it axes at work because they needed it for work. Many people anecdotally that I've talked to who have a subscription to the Australian's online offering, it's the same. Probably harder to justify. And also the content is more unashamedly entertainment as well. So you know, it's very much about the footy. There'll be a strong footy sort of section for, which will be sort of, you know, new content for the Herald Sun. And also, you know, that kind of nitty-gritty stuff like, I think it's called True Crime Scene, but yeah, it's sort of kind of focused on, you know, Melbourne loves its crime. That's why Underbelly was so popular. So, yeah, it's about pure entertainment. And that's the question, is will people pay for entertainment in the same way that companies sign it off? I think it's a slightly longer road, I would say. James?
Well, if you look at the Daily Mail being the biggest online paper right now, I don't think that means that it can't succeed. The problem is the wall, not the content. And I think rushing into it so early, when if you look at other models like the New York Times, what they've done is they've tried to chase their offline subscribers into using online to see the benefits of it, so that in the end, when they move offline, they've got an online place that they see there's real value in, and in the end may well pay for it. So there are clear steps that other markets are trying in order to corral people into paying for online. I think just putting up the wall and not doing the subscriber base first is probably a mistake.
Would also, you know, you mentioned AFR and the Australian, they're very much still reporting in a print mode, you know, text mode, as opposed to these tabloids, which are bringing in a lot more. They're bringing in their social media, they're bringing in video. Should these broadsheets, or however we, you know, Australian AFR, should they be getting a little more digital savvy to lure us in? Should they be offering more than just text?
I think another important point is that I would say most Australian online newspapers have not really thought through the user experience. So they're quite clunky to use. They're not really fun and engaging, and their iPad apps are not terribly...
Well, I mean, I might defend them slightly in terms of, I'm not sure it's like they haven't thought through, but certainly they haven't yet done it.
Perhaps they lack the expertise or the experience.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair point. You know, it doesn't feel like a genuinely multimedia experience when you're looking at the iPad apps in particular. But I think some of it as well is still, for the most part, it's repurposing of content that was created for a print product. Now, over time, obviously, that will change. But, you know, that's where they're at the moment.
Mm. And if you think about their economic model, once they move out of trucks, presses and nice buildings, they're able to put more money into the content to actually properly repurpose it. Because right now, 2/3 of what should be going into their future, digital, is going into buildings and presses.
If you were Fairfax, would you just close the Monday to Friday edition of the SMH, the print version, and maybe The Age, carry on publishing on a Saturday, you know, go digital now, make the jump while you still can?
You're going to have to make the digital jump. It wouldn't be smart to close down your existing revenue stream in order to be able to do that. The reality is they need to set up their organisation to be ready for the future, which is smaller, more nimble, obviously totally digital, and make sure they understand the different platforms that they're going to have to address. So we're talking about the iPad, but the reality is in the future, 2-3 years' time, people, whilst they're going to spend a lot of time on the iPad reading newspapers, it's going to be from their desktop, from their mobile, and from their iPad. And the content right now is not delivered for three different platforms. It's basically, as you're saying, just repurposed, and hopefully it's going to, you know, land in a way which is readable.
And actually, a print-based question, if you were the Australian, if you were the SMH, would you go from broadsheet to tabloid format?
Well, I think it's been tried in a number of other markets and it's been relatively successful. I think it's a format which people like, but I think it's dodging the bullet. The reality is it's not about paper.
Would you as an agency pay as much for a full page ad in a tabloid as you would for a broadsheet?
Absolutely depends on the audience and who you're looking for. The reality is people are paying more for a tabloid.
But for instance, if you were to get page 5 of the SMH now versus page 5 of the tabloid format SMH, would you expect the same rate card for both?
I would expect a different rate card, yes.
And would that be the reason why they haven't yet gone tabloid, do you think?
They have right now flatlined on revenue, which for any newspaper owner in the world, they'd kill for that. If you look at the US, in 5 years, they've hemorrhaged from $60 billion in the newspaper industry down to $20 billion, 5 years. And this market has actually flatlined. It's fundamentally different. The reality is that the crossover is where it will change. And I said 2.5 to 3 years' time, they'll see their revenue falling through the floor. And if they haven't worked out in these 2.5 years what they have to do online, they're in massive trouble.
We've seen magazines, you know, sort of magazines that cover a broad spectrum or to the general public sort of slacken off in sales, while boutique magazines like Frankie have kind of gone up. Will we ever see that in newspapers, where newspapers will have a boutique model? Is there such a thing? I don't know.
Yeah, they're called local newspapers.
Right. Okay.
Well, I suppose that's the thing, is it? Because, yeah, I guess the question is, yeah, can you create some other sort of community apart from local that still has a newspaper feel?
Yeah, you can. Just drop the paper bit.
What about the Global Mail? That might actually be quite a good example of a boutique, you know, global newspaper.
True. In related news, Mumbrella will be hoisting our paywall as of today. all money can be sent to cash to discocole@hotmail.com. Next, Scoop-On's big meal deal.
This week, group buying site Scoop-On announced they'd done a deal with Hungry Jack's, offering $2 Whopper and fries. It's the biggest fast food deal on group buying to date and shifted more than 600,000 vouchers. Now, Kathy, you wrote about this. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's important to note, as many of our commenters have pointed out in the thread, that these are not actual sales. These are downloads of a voucher, so you still have to cough up your $2 when you go to the store. But, I mean, it's pretty astronomical. It crashed the site. It's, you know, nearly 500,000 $2 burger deals sold to greedy Australians.
James, what's the marketing logic for Hungry Jack's doing something like this? Because presumably the cost of the product they're putting in people's hands is more than $2, the cost to them.
Well, that's the only thing that's up for debate. I'm not sitting in the marketing room, but I'd right now guess that they're having a problem with footfall and they need to grow their franchise. Obviously, McDonald's is number one in the market by a long way, and they need to rectify that. So I'd look at this as a paid sampling program. They're at least getting it offset by people volunteering to give $2 for this sample. But they're trying to get people in there to remember that it's not a bad experience, and hopefully they'll come back. So the real measure of success of this is not redemption on coupons. It's the month after this stops, and if they've had retrial or their average frequency has gone up.
The point has been made, though, that it's just Burger King customers who are already loyal to the brand, who are, you know, delighted at this bargain deal, rather than, you know, converting at other fast food fans.
So that's typical of every promotion. There is no difference here. Mm. The reality is, though, there will also be lapsed and light who will also come into this. And you've got to hope that they will do then the retrial, etc., the month after. So, yeah, this is no different to any other promotion.
What is your view on group buying generally? Is it always valuable to brands, or are there cautions you should apply to it if you become involved?
The reality is all the success stories we talk about are linked to PR. So no brand is seeing this as adding any sort of value from any attribute that they're trying to grow. But certainly if there's a stunt, or if it's something that's going to get broader appeal, in this case they need a penetration drive or increased footfall and hopefully average frequency the month after, there's a marketing reason for it. But again, they're driving the PR of it. It's about popularity. It's about getting into pop culture.
Scoop-On claims it's the second most successful voucher sale to run on a group buying site anywhere in the world. And by contrast, when Living Social did a deal with McDonald's in the US, offering a bulk bulk buy burger deal, Macca's saw 291,748 vouchers sold over 24 hours. James, when group buying sites became popular, they seemed a little more elitist, thrifty. They had cheap.
Hang on, I'm sorry, I can't let you go beyond that phrase.
No,
elitist, thrifty.
Well, they were getting cheap deals for nice restaurants rather than cheap deals for fast food restaurants. Are group buying sites just about moving units and can they damage a brand?
Yeah, does it make it seem cheap?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the cachet of finding smart stuff on these group buying sites has long since gone. I think right now these guys have volume to push. And if you look at the number of group buying sites, that means everyone can't have a good deal. So the aggregator group buying site is yet to appear, but it will. And that will help us understand what is of value in any of these sites. But right now, if you go through almost all of them, there is little value to be found. It's all inventory that we need to be dumped.
Next, send the Bondi hipsters out of the country.
Dom and Adrian, the Bondi hipsters, self-appointed style icons for Sydney's eastern suburbs, have put out a call to brands to sponsor their reporting of the London Olympics. Let's take a quick listen.
My name's Dom.
My name's Adrian. People call me AIDS.
Full blown.
What?
If you're lucky enough to be hanging out with us right now, it probably means that you've bought an Olympic sponsorship package.
Cool.
So I'm no marketing guru, but it's highly likely you're going to receive some coverage on television, magazines, newspapers, and radio, and all those other dinosauric dying out media outlets.
Sorry to interrupt you, Dom, with my yawn, but for a moment there, as you said TV and radio and whatnot, I became really fucking bored. TV's great if you're in 1982.
If you want your brand to be associated with old people, then you're going the right way about it. I'm not your marketing manager, but might I just suggest that you look at investing in the digital space a little more? Ever heard of a thing called content?
Right now, we're in an age where the internet is a significant tool of communication. This is something that Dom and Adrian have a hold on.
What Dom and Adrian, which is me and him, would like to do is to go over to London and represent your brand in a series of Olympic content.
Yes, we'll give you results of the biggest Olympic events daily. Who won gold? Who won silver? Who won bronze? Yes, we will tell you about any Olympic-related controversy. We stand to take that a step further.
We will also tell you about the hottest parties from around London that are happening during the Olympic Games and all the controversy that goes down there.
And we also want to talk about Olympic-related travel. What are the hot spots in London? What are the hot spots throughout England?
Where Banksy has painted his original artworks.
Who's Banksy?
Sorry, Banksy.
Banksy. Banksy's so good.
The Olympic fashion, what's hot and what's not.
We want to go places where these mainstream media people will not want to go.
It'll basically be like Roy and HG's Olympic coverage, but with two younger, better looking dudes in skinny leg jeans and two guys who don't smell like cheese and cabbage and who are probably going to die and who old people listen to. I think. I don't know. I don't know any old people. Sorry for turning the whole industry on its head. Sorry for doing things differently and for just trying to come up with a media strategy that would be more effective than your boring TV, newspaper, radio thing.
Sign me up. The duo are actually Christian Van Vuren, former JC Deco staffer and fully sick rapper, and Nick Boschier, who created Beached As, the viral of the whale on the little beach. And they've created the concept for Sydney-based Infinity Squared, who've worked with McDonald's and ASICS. James, what do you think? Reckon they'll get a sponsor?
Outside of a creative agency, no.
I suppose the question is, versus the cost of being a top-tier sponsor of Nine's Olympic coverage, I suspect that the price of Dom and Adrian might be a little more affordable for the brand on a budget.
Well, a similar-sized audience.
That's true. Now, the Olympics, is it already a big deal for the agency? Are there specific brands which actually are going to have to do stuff around it?
Well, there are brands which have got long-standing relationships with the Olympics, but obviously they'll be partaking and they will be doing their best to leverage it.
And are there any that you look after?
Yeah, Mitsubishi.
What will they be doing?
Well, obviously, they have a whole lot of work which is done with their dealers. It's obviously a really important trade marketing tool, as well as trying to leverage whatever else will be done globally to make sure that there's some value for it that locally, because obviously paid for at a global level, and what you've got to try and do is make sure you amplify whatever's being done and make the best of that particular buy.
And how far out something like the Olympics do you really start getting down to the nitty-gritty of what the plan is? You know, at this point, is it all pretty much done?
Yeah, about a year and a half out.
And what about booking airtime around it? Is that a little bit closer? Do you sort of hold off in the hope that, you know, you can get a good price if it comes closer? Or?
Well, I leave that to Seb Rennie, our agent provocateur, when it comes to doing that sort of deal. I don't get involved.
Now, Kathy, you are, I'm afraid it has to be said, and there is no nice way of saying this, a Bondi hipster.
I don't believe it has to be said at all.
You're a former media strategist who is known to use the word content whilst riding the 333 bus from Circular Quay and back to the sea, of which there is a song.
You know me, I'm on the 333, Bondi, please, to Circular Quay. I say, you know me, I'm on the 333, Circular Quay, then back to the sea.
Would your advice be to a brand to get on board?
First of all, I actually live in Nobo rather than Bondi.
No, Nobo.
Actually, I think that despite the obvious ridiculous nature of the concept, the guys have got quite a smart, I think, a bit of insight into, I mean, obviously mainstream media is covered throughout the Olympics with brands and sponsorship deals. And I think that what they're offering is a way of maybe a more, I suppose, hipster brand reaching a smaller online youth audience.
It would have to be an ironically hipster brand.
Well, they've said Ryobi, because that would be ironic.
Totes ironic, yeah, that's true. But I mean, they do notch up perhaps 30,000 views on YouTube, which is a bit small potatoes.
120,000 with the most recent.
Really?
Yeah, but, I believe so.
Well, this was my question. You're right, they're sitting at around 30,000 for most of their sketches, and then they bring out the Life Organic last week, and it is around 120.
Thanks to its coverage, perhaps, in some sort of leading trade press.
I'm not sure we can claim 120,000 views of what we do.
We will take Coney, though. My question is, would this have been something that they'd been working up to and waited until they got their biggest result, which is the Life Organic, to drop their pitch, which is what we just heard?
There's no Machiavellian plan with these guys, and they haven't been planning for 18 months out for the Olympics.
I think they thought it up while sitting on North Bondi's grassy knoll. I think that's actually
smoking,
what happened.
Smoking their hip cigarettes.
But, I mean, genuinely, perhaps a brand, you know, a Bondi bar might sponsor them to sit at home, watch television and cover the Olympics in that sense. I think that might work.
Next, Bob Catter targets gay marriage.
An attack ad by Bob Catter's Australian party on Queensland election rival Campbell Newman, and not to mention on the gay and lesbian community, began airing this week, and it's already received more than 300 complaints to the Ad Standards Bureau for being homophobic. Let's take a listen.
How well do you really know Campbell Newman? Do you think he'll stand up for your family values? Do you think he'll really stand up to the Greens and other minority groups? Then think again. The LNP leader supports gay marriage, just like Greens leader Bob Brown.
I support gay marriage. I support gay marriage.
That's right, he supports gay marriage.
But the LNP leader does back gay marriage.
Well, I've said before that I support gay marriage.
Is a vote for LNP leader Campbell Newman a vote for gay marriage?
Authorised by Luke Shaw, Catter's Australia Party, Brisbane.
So, Colin, an ad like that, I must confess, the great thing about the podcast is I don't have to be journalistically neutral. When I first heard that, I thought it was actually the work of somebody who was perhaps mentally ill. and I genuinely thought I had to check, because
that's
I didn't...
still not unproved.
No. Yeah.
Catter is behind it.
Yeah, but the thing is, I also thought this can't actually be a genuine ad. It's a spoof. I can't believe that people are linking to it. And then you check, and yes, it is on the official YouTube channel of the party. How's this playing with the ASB?
Well, actually, the ASB doesn't deal with political ad complaints. That's dealt with by their ACMA, or ACMA, Australian Communications and Media Authority. And So I'm not.
So they just had to answer the phone 300 times and say, "Can you ring ACMA?"
Please? Yeah, exactly. If you're calling about a CATA, please call. It'll get passed on to ACMA.
And what has CATA been saying about it?
Well, he said he loves it. He said that the image that was used was not dissimilar to Queensland's rip and roll campaign done by the Queensland Healthy Community that was to promote use of condoms within the gay community. Which was controversial for another reason, but was passed by the Ad Standards Bureau. So I guess he's suggesting that his should also be passed because the image he's using. However, of course, his message is entirely different.
James, let's give you a hypothetical. you're a media agency, you're advising a political party and they create a message along those lines. Would it be a good idea to put that to air?
Well, one, choose your party carefully. If it's a non-for-profit, which I'm assuming this is, it's obviously an approach that they have decided to take because it's smart, because it'll get them the PR coverage that we're giving them right now. And we are propagating their message for them. And in the end, it will fall on enough ears that actually like it. So, job done.
Kathy?
I just wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, I think.
Next, The Week in TV.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
This week, the production company Cordel Jigsaw announced it sold the format of Go Back to Where You Came From to US network BBC America. Colin, you wrote this story. Can you explain a bit further?
Yeah, sure. So basically, this follows on from European sales of the format. I spoke with Michael Cordell. Actually, this is a quote from Michael Cordell from the press release. He said, "We're cock-a-hoop about the format sales."
That's a quote from the press release because people never say that sort of thing in real life.
That's something you type and think, genius. Instead of being a dumping ground for overseas formats, for once, an Australian format is being exported to the rest of the world. Hopefully, it will help balance out our cultural terms of trade. It comes just after Cordell Jigsaw, who also did the recent Great Mint Swindle, which aired on Nine, the telly movie.
It wasn't a disaster, but
8:30 Sunday night just got over just a million, 1.08.
Did you see it?
I didn't see it, unfortunately. Just moved house, don't have a telly set up.
I didn't actually see it, but I did look at Twitter to see what people were saying about it, which is much the same thing. Mm. And it was very positively received.
Fantastic, good. It also comes just a couple of weeks after Cordell Jigsaw merged with Andrew Denton's Zapruder's other films, who of course make Gruen Transfer and the successful yet finished Hungry Beast.
And the forthcoming Randling,
which Denton will host, to become the largest independent production company in Australia, with 14 shows slated for 2012. They're very much wanting to sell their formats. Not only are they wanting to make original Australian content, but they realise that the money is actually in making formats that they can sell overseas. So when I did speak to Nick Murray, who's the Jigsaw in Cordell Jigsaw, he said the whole idea of the merger is to compete with international companies such as Southern Star Endemol, owned by Silvio Berlusconi, Shine, owned by News and Rupert Murdoch, Granada and Fremantle, which are owned by the German company RTL. He said it gives us a critical mass to have a seat at the table. As I said, obviously their high priority is to not only make great original Australian content, but to sell that content and those formats to overseas, because that's where the big money is.
James, how often do you, from where you're sitting, do you actually see something coming in front of you which you think, actually, that's genuinely original television? That's something I would love to involve my brand in for that reason.
And the reality is not very often. Unfortunately, I think this particular format has hit a nerve. It's something that's topical. It feels really contemporary in its approach. It's got the docudrama, human element, plus involves something which is very close to a lot of the Western world in terms of the big immigration problem. It's not unique to Australia. People wanted to push people back offshore. It's, you know, something that everyone is experiencing, and the States will go down particularly well, given that they've got their problems with their border and people leaking across. So I think it's a format that's found its time. And I think it'll do really, really well.
Now, Colin, another big move in TV production. Rory Callaghan has moved from CEO at, we were mentioning Southern Star, where he was before, to executive director at Shine. What does that mean?
Yeah, interesting one. He announced he was stepping down from Southern Star a few months ago. Southern Star, of course, makes shows like Rush and Tangled, and they'll be doing the upcoming Beaconsfield telemovie, as well as upcoming Puberty Blues miniseries. They did Paper Giants, and all as well as some reality, but they're very drama based, courtesy mainly to John Edwards, the producer. So yeah, I mean, to me it feels like his move to Shine might be a sign that Shine's trying to get into the drama, which they don't have any real scripted drama shows at all. They're very reality based. Who can forget The Renovators? So I mean, but his,
go on, tell us your description of The Renovators.
Running with lamps. His quote was interesting. To paraphrase, he basically said, "It's great to have spent so much time at the number one production company," and then he followed that up by saying he was moving to the most dynamic, which kind of sounds like a demotion. And also he's going from CEO to working under Mark Fennessy and also Matt Campbell. An interesting move. Not one I would have done, but I'm not the CEO of anything.
No, you're not. Elsewhere in television, Ten has been on something of a roller coaster this week. It's Super Sunday was very much stolen away this week. We saw early in the evening, Nine put Great Barrier Reef out, which kind of sucked away a lot of the audience from Young Talent time. And then as the evening went on, Seven launched a Sunday episode of the My Kitchen Rules franchise, which did very well, and which was bad news for the rest of Ten's night, including New Girl and Homeland. A pretty miserable Monday, but one of its bigger Tuesdays of the year, jumping to second place behind Seven, moving just ahead of Nine, who inexplicably five American comedies in a row didn't rate brilliantly. Seven, meanwhile, had about a 30% share, 10, 17.6. James, what are your TV habits?
Bit of a Homeland addict.
So you're one that you've been sticking with it.
Yeah, I have.
Have you been watching it as scheduled? Are you recording it and watching it later, or some other way of accessing it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a time shift, so I'll probably watch it a little bit later than live, but it is sort of delayed live, if you know what I mean.
What has been interesting about time shifting as well is just this year the sort of numbers that Ten's delivering from time shifting. We've seen numbers like 30%. Uplift for audience, haven't we? Which obviously says something about the Ten demographic, you know, that audience is more likely to come in through that way. But yeah, does it eventually just make the overnight ratings kind of irrelevant, do you think?
Well, I think as a currency right now, that's what we have, that's what we're going to use going forward. It's only when, again, some sort of crossover appears where we're getting a critical mass on, you know, time shifting, and then it'll stop being relevant, and that's when they'll have to find something else.
Kathy, your TV habits?
Mostly, I don't own a television, so mostly downloading. And
Legally.
Will I hipster come to
I have a 37-inch Mac to which I...
to which I buy DVDs from the shop and play them at a time that's convenient to me. And I fast-forward adverts, should I ever encounter them.
That is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much to James.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you to Kathy.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you to Colin.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, as ever, to Noise International for the theme tune. The Umbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.
Dom and Adrian, self-appointed style icon for... It's harder than it looks. Kudos to Robin.
At least you're going to have no problems with that type.
Exactly.
You've got plenty.